This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Sean Curran at Westminster with the Today in Parliament podcast for Thursday, the 2nd of November, when the Leader of the Commons said Parliament had to change in the wake of accusations of sexual harassment.
This has been a difficult week for Parliament, but it has been even harder for those who've come forward to report their experiences.
The Brexit papers. David Davis says he will hand them over.
Of course, we will be as open as we can be with the Select Committee. I fully intend to.
There's a call for more unaccompanied child refugees to be offered sanctuary in the UK.
In Calais, still, children are sleeping outdoors at the mercy of the elements and, dare I say, the police.
And MPs say schools aren't doing enough to tackle sexual harassment and abuse. The Prime Minister had to reshuffle her cabinet this morning in the wake of the sudden resignation of Sir Michael Fallon. He stood down as Defence Secretary on Wednesday night following allegations of inappropriate sexual behaviour in the past. Theresa May has promoted her Chief Whip, Gavin Williamson, to take over at the Ministry of Defence. The enforced changes came just hours after Mrs. May had invited the leaders of the political parties at Westminster to a meeting to agree new independent procedures to deal with allegations of sexual harassment and abuse. Today, the Leader of the Commons, Andrea Leadsom, said that meeting would take place on Monday.
This has been a difficult week for Parliament, but it has been even harder for those who've come forward to report their experiences of inappropriate behaviour, harassment or abuse. Their experiences are why we need to change.
Andrea Leadsom said she was confident all sides wanted to resolve the problem.
A cross-party solution is the only solution, and I want to thank everyone I've met for showing commitment to that proper solution. I've also had further meetings on these issues, including with the Clerk of the House and a discussion with the Commissioner for Standards. I told the House that action would be taken in days, not weeks, and that is exactly what is happening.
The Shadow Leader of the Commons, Valerie Vaz, said Labour was committed to finding a common process to deal with the issues.
But a change of culture could take longer, and that must be done by education and training. Every member and every employee should go on an equality training course. For new MPs, it could be part of the induction process. And existing members of staff should also undergo this.
The SNP's Pete Wishart congratulated Andrea Leadsom for the leadership she'd shown on the sexual harassment issue.
And it's encouraging to see people now coming forward and firm and decisive action being taken. But does she agree with me? This is a real opportunity to effectively tackle the inbuilt patriarchal hierarchy of this institution and the unsavoury entitlement culture that still pervades these corridors of power.
A Labour MP, Barry Shearman, thought journalists working at Westminster should be included in any changes.
Because I know that there are some elements in the media and journalism who treat women in not the same way as they treat men. And I think they should be involved in this conversation, the press gallery. I think that would be very good for us.
Another Labour MP, Rachel Maskell, supported the call for training.
I am deeply concerned about the bullying culture within Parliament, an issue that actually was dismissed by Mr. Speaker when I previously have raised it with him, determining it to be a women's issue. It clearly isn't.
Andrea Leadsom said the Commons had to get things right once and for all. Later, the Commons Speaker John Bercow denied that he'd dismissed Rachel Maskell's concerns about bullying as women's issues. In a letter to the MP, he said he would never use that form of words. Now, the Brexit Secretary, David Davis, says he will hand over a series of documents assessing how the UK's departure from the European Union will affect the economy. Ministers had argued that publication would undermine the UK's negotiating position in the Brexit talks. But the Commons approved a Labour motion calling for the papers to be released to the Brexit Select Committee. Alicia McCarthy reports.
The government chose not to take part in last night's vote, which meant Labour's demand for the 58 sectoral impact assessments to be released to the Brexit Committee was passed. Immediately after the debate, there were demands from opposition MPs for the information to be released quickly and in full to the committee. By coincidence, today in the Commons began with questions to the department for exiting the EU, and it didn't take long for Labour frontbencher Keir Starmer to ask what would happen now.
You, Mr Speaker, indicate it wasn't a motion that needed to be deliberated over for a long time. When will the papers be handed over?
He was putting his question to the Brexit Minister, Robin Walker, who wasn't giving anything away.
I said that we would respond appropriately, and we will do as soon as conceivable.
So another Labour MP, Jeff Smith, tried again a little later, quoting the Conservative backbencher, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and demanding the papers be handed over without any sections being blanked out.
Does he agree with his right honourable friend, the member for North East Somerset, who said that the government must give the papers to the Select Committee in full? Or does he not trust the Select Committee?
Replying this time, the Secretary of State for Exiting the EU, David Davis. He said he'd already spoken to the Labour MP who chairs the Brexit Committee, Hilary Benn.
I'm organising to talk to him about how we handle the confidentiality of the documentation we'll hand over. I will reiterate the point made by my honourable friend, and that is these documents are not some sort of grand plan. They're data about the regulations and the markets of individual sectors which inform our negotiation. And, of course, we will be as open as we can be with the Select Committee. I fully intend to.
Another Labour backbencher, Seema Malhotra, kept up the pressure.
Could the ministers perhaps confirm what they mean by due course? And if they don't know yet, when will they?
In due course.
As swiftly as possible in the circumstances, she was told. A Conservative, Nigel Evans, thought this wasn't just about documents held by the government.
I assume that the European Union has done something similar as to what they're going to do when they lose £10 to £12 billion a year. And indeed, the German government may have done one about the impact to the German car industry, and the French may have done one about the wine industry in France. Has he received any representations from any of the politicians opposite to press those governments to publish their dossiers?
He was told that all sides would be conducting an analysis of everyone's negotiating capital. Well, a short time later, at questions to the Leader of the Commons, the SNP's Pete Wishart, said what was needed now was a clear and unambiguous statement from the government.
That it accepts in full what was decided last time, without qualification, without any sense of redaction, just hand the papers over to the DEXU committee, and that's what's expected of this government tonight. Now, if it doesn't do this, as you said, Mr Speaker, the government will be in contempt of this House, and if that happens, we will be bringing proceedings to hold them to account.
The Leader of the Commons, Andrea Leadsom, sought to reassure Pete Wishart that the government had accepted the vote calling for the papers to be released.
This will be met, but it is a case of trying to balance the public interest with the binding nature of that vote.
But it wasn't just MPs who wanted to see the documents. Down the corridor, Lord Kinnoull, a crossbench or independent peer, said David Davis had previously promised the Lords EU Committee, of which he was a member, the same information as the Commons.
Could I ask the noble Lord Minister to go further than saying that he will have a discussion with our chairman about things, but actually to undertake that we would receive the same information as the equivalent committee in the House of Commons?
The Lords Brexit Minister, Lord Callanan, has only been in the job since Monday. He said discussions were continuing with the Select Committee chairs, but he didn't want to go any further than that for now. A Conservative former Chancellor, Lord Lawson, had a rather different view.
Is this all not a lot of nonsense?
Lord Lawson reckoned when it came to the impact of Brexit, the Treasury's short-term forecasts had shown it hadn't a clue, and the longer-term impacts depended on the policies put in place after Brexit. But as those policies weren't in place yet...
This is a complete farce, and the opposition is simply seeking to embarrass the government in the face of... which is what opposition do in the face of an international negotiation.
Lord Callanan said he wasn't sure he'd use the word fast to describe parliamentary procedure and repeated the Brexit department would be as open and transparent as possible.
Alicia McCarthy. You're listening to Today in Parliament with me, Sean Curran. Still to come, the continuing crisis in Catalonia, and the Northern Ireland secretary is challenged over the continuing political impasse there.
What is the magic wand that he thinks in the next few weeks is really going to make any difference?
But before that, there's been a call for more unaccompanied child refugees in Europe to be offered sanctuary in the UK in time for Christmas. MPs complained the British government wasn't doing enough and that vulnerable youngsters were sleeping rough in France, Greece and Italy. Christina Cooper reports.
A year ago, the French authorities cleared and demolished the refugee camp in Calais, called the jungle because of the crowded, unsanitary conditions there. But the challenge of dealing with people displaced by conflict has not gone away, as the former Liberal Democrat leader, Tim Farron, pointed out.
Images of families and children in makeshift refugee camps around Calais have disappeared from the front pages and from our Facebook timelines. But the refugee crisis has not abated across Europe. We continue to face the biggest humanitarian crisis since the 1940s.
Some MPs think the UK should be offering sanctuary to more refugees, especially lone children in other European countries. Under an EU agreement known as Dublin III, the UK accepts refugees who have relatives in the country. In another scheme, the UK will accept children who arrive alone at entry points to Europe, such as Greece or Italy, regardless of family ties here. Many MPs had hoped that under what's called the Dub scheme, 3,000 children would be resettled, but the figure so far is 200. And ministers say only a further 280 children will be accepted. The Conservative, Heidi Allen, who sponsored this debate, said she was disappointed by the UK's contribution.
In Calais, still, children are sleeping outdoors at the mercy of the elements and, dare I say, the police, because the official shelter that the French government have provided can only house 60. In Greece, over 1,800 children are waiting for a space in such a shelter, and when they make it, they'll actually find it is, in fact, a disused prison. In Italy, the situation is even more chaotic.
She hoped the remaining 280 places under the Dub scheme would be filled as soon as possible.
Can we aim for the end of the year? Call me sentimental, but can we aim for Christmas?
The debate took place as the government won a court case on the Dub scheme. The charity Help Refugees had argued that the consultation with councils, leading to the view that only 480 children should be accepted, was fundamentally flawed. But the High Court ruled that the process had been sound. Co-sponsoring the debate was the Labour MP Stella Creasy, who maintained that the government had not consulted widely enough.
We may not have seen the High Court agree with us, but it is worth recording that what the High Court was discussing was the fact that the government simply hadn't asked even the Northern Irish government about what they could do. Certainly the Scottish authorities were told not to respond. A third of English authorities didn't respond to the consultation.
The Conservative, Charlie Elphick, felt the focus should be on accepting children with family in the UK. But the best approach, he said, was to provide people with places of safety close to the conflict zones.
So that when conflict ends, they can go home, than it is to in any way risk incentivising a dangerous journey to be made across the whole of Europe. Because we've seen on our television screens how that often ends up in such tragedy.
The MP who represents Dover and can see Calais from his bedroom window explained the impact of migration in his area.
I get complaints from my constituents in Kent that we have about a quarter, getting on for a quarter of the unaccompanied asylum-seeking children in the whole of this country. And they are concerned about the pressure on public services that that places on Kent.
The Home Office Minister, Brandon Lewis, said everyone wanted to do the right thing by vulnerable children. He said some of the remarks made during the debate had not been accurate. On the Dub scheme, he said the UK was working closely with France and other countries to resettle 480 lone children in the UK.
Quite the opposite of what some members have said this afternoon about that process having stopped. It hasn't, it never has, it is still open. A High Court ruling, in fact, handed down today, as has been referred to earlier on, has confirmed that the government's approach to implementing Section 67 has been lawful.
His comments about the Dub scheme got the attention of Yvette Cooper, the Labour chair of the Home Affairs Committee.
The Minister, I think, has just said that he said the Dub scheme is not closed. So will he then agree now to contact again local councils across the country and to ask them what further places they could provide under the Dub scheme for next year?
The Minister repeated that the court had found the process to be lawful. He said children had arrived in recent weeks from France and the government was working with Greece to ensure the safe transfer of eligible children. But he added that the UK could not simply remove people from other countries. The UK had to respect their sovereignty and national child protection laws.
Christina Cooper. Spain has been gripped by a political crisis since the regional Catalan government held an independence referendum in defiance of a constitutional court ruling. The Foreign Office Minister, Sir Alan Duncan, stressed to MPs that Catalonia was an internal matter for Spain and its people.
Spain is a close ally and a good friend whose strength and unity matters to us, and we consider it essential that the rule of law be upheld and the Spanish constitution respected.
But Plaid Cymru's Howell Williams, who'd asked an urgent question about the situation, said the UK government had a role to play.
No one, I think, can doubt that this is eventually a political rather than a legal matter. Getting both parties to talk is the way forward. In this situation, the UK government has a responsibility and an opportunity.
Sir Allen said it was a legal matter. The independence referendum had been illegal. Labour's shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry, said the future of Catalonia had been turned into a binary choice.
That is a false choice, an impossible choice, between on the one hand a unilateral declaration of independence and on the other direct rule from Madrid. I do not believe that either of those choices offers a satisfactory solution to this crisis, and I do not believe that either choice is what the majority of Catalans or Spaniards actually want.
Emily Thornberry said the situation was very dangerous and condemned the use of what she said was officially sanctioned violence and intimidation by the police, resulting in horrific scenes. The Shadow Foreign Secretary also criticised the government for not doing a lot in relation to the crisis. The SNP's Peter Grant said ministers could and should do more.
Will the government agree to put pressure on the European Union to offer to act as a mediator so that the wishes of the people of Catalonia and of the people of Spain can be resolved in a way that does not involve any further unlawful acts by the Spanish state?
Yeah.
Sir Alan Duncan replied that, by and large, the answer to almost everything that the MP had asked was no. Earlier this week, the Justice Secretary, David Lidington, indicated that the government was about to make a concession on prisoner voting and bring to an end a long-running legal battle. In 2005, the European Court of Human Rights ruled against the UK's blanket ban on allowing prisoners to vote. Today, Mr. Lidington said the government still believed that convicted offenders who were in prison should not be allowed to vote. But he announced what he called administrative changes to address points made by the court 12 years ago. In future, it'll be made clear to criminals when they're being sentenced that when they're in prison, they'll lose the right to vote. And a handful of prisoners will be allowed to vote.
Release on temporary licence is a tool typically used to allow offenders to commute from prison to employment in the community and so prepare themselves for their return to society. We believe that reinstating the civic right of voting at this point is consistent with that approach.
The Justice Secretary said the change would affect around 100 people at any one time. His Labour shadow, Richard Bergen, complained that the government had been slow to deal with the issue. He thought most MPs would agree that prisoners serving life sentences for murder should not be able to vote. But he wanted to be sure that the government's proposals satisfied the UK's international obligations to uphold human rights.
Because the last thing that this House wants is the Secretary of State having to come back to the House at some point in the future and explain that, unfortunately, this hasn't satisfied the test and isn't fulfilling our international obligations and our commitments. I'm sure the government doesn't want that, and we certainly don't want that either.
The Conservative chair of the Justice Committee, Robert Neil, praised David Lidington for having grasped the nettle that none of his predecessors had grasped. A Labour MP, Kate Green, said the change was a small step and mildly welcome. Another Labour opponent of the blanket ban was Kerry McCarthy.
This is really a very tiny concession by the government. It's the bare minimum it could get away with. And I believe that when you imprison somebody, you deprive them of their liberty, you don't deprive them of their rights. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand, and perhaps the minister could tell me, why he feels so threatened by that.
But some Conservative backbenchers like Philip Davis were unhappy with the idea of giving any prisoners the vote.
The Secretary of State knows that I think giving the vote to any prisoners is idiotic, unjustifiable, and is about as popular with the general public as finding a rattlesnake in a lucky dip.
He thought there should be a vote in the Commons, but David Lidington said the government wasn't proposing a change in the law, but a change to prison service guidance. Now, there's still no power-sharing executive in Northern Ireland. The latest talks to end the deadlock collapsed earlier this week. The Northern Ireland Secretary, James Brokenshire, is taking steps for Westminster to set a budget. But he said that didn't mean a return to direct rule. Here's Simon Jones.
Northern Ireland's power-sharing executive collapsed in January over the handling of a renewable energy scheme. Since then, talks between the Democratic Unionist Party and Sinn Féin have failed to reach an agreement on the restoration of devolved government. The Northern Ireland Secretary, James Brokenshire, said the impasse meant the UK government would have to set a budget for Northern Ireland.
While important progress has been made, the parties have not yet reached an agreement. Therefore, I'm not in a position to bring before the House the legislation necessary for an executive to be formed this week. The consequence of this is that it is now highly unlikely that an executive could be in place within a timetable to be assured of passing a budget by the end of November.
Mr. Brokenshire said without a budget, Northern Ireland would run out of money, and ministers couldn't allow that to happen.
The government's strong desire would be for a restored executive in Northern Ireland to take for its own budget. So this step is one that I am now taking with the utmost reluctance and only in the absence of any other option. I also want to be clear to the House that passing a budget in Westminster does not mark a move to direct rule.
Labour's shadow Northern Ireland Secretary, Owen Smith, thought more could have been done.
We believe that the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland could get stuck into this problem and try and bring about a resolution of the impasse. It is, in my view, inexcusable and completely inexplicable that she has only visited Northern Ireland once during her 15 months in office.
Mr. Smith said ministers were right to bring forward a budget, but warned them direct rule would be profoundly damaging. He suggested allowing the Northern Ireland Assembly to have some sort of shadow capacity in the process as a step back towards devolution. The deputy leader of the DUP, Nigel Dodds, predicted that direct rule was not far off.
We would set the government up tomorrow.
Yeah.
Sinn Féin are blocking it. So the Secretary of State is perfectly right to come to this House, as we have been urging, to get the budget set. And I would also say to him that we cannot allow the drift to continue. That at some point in the very near future, we will need to have ministers. And if they are not Northern Ireland executive ministers, which is what we want and other parties want, but Sinn Féin are blocking that, then it will have to be ministers from here.
James Brokenshire said the restoration of devolution had to be the goal.
And I would encourage him and his party to continue, I know, the efforts that they have done over an extended period to find that way forward, to see what is that space for agreement, to provide that sense of stability for Northern Ireland, which we all want to see.
The SNP's Deirdre Brock said people were disappointed at the failure to reach a deal.
It is essential control is passed back to Belfast as soon as is politically possible. So can the Secretary of State tell us exactly what the insurmountable barriers are that the Stormont politicians face and how he intends to break them down?
A Conservative, Bob Blackman, hoped Mr. Brokenshire would stop the budget process if a deal was agreed.
And that he will take, during the time when he has these powers under legislation, input from the Northern Ireland parties to make sure that spending decisions are taken in the best interests of the people of Northern Ireland.
And the Liberal Democrat and former Coalition Cabinet Minister Alistair Carmichael went a step further.
The Assembly itself could be reconvened as a body to which reference could be made and could be consulted with by ministers here as they go about the business of administering what they have to do.
Labour's Kate Hoey said people were becoming frustrated.
What is the magic wand that he thinks in the next few weeks is really going to make any difference, given that one party is quite happy to go back into government right away, into the Assembly, and another is putting ridiculous demands which were not there at the beginning?
James Brokenshire said direct rule was not the answer and an agreement was possible.
Simon Jones. Now, earlier in the programme, we heard the Leader of the Commons, Andrea Leadsom, tell MPs it had been a difficult week for Parliament. A few hours later, the Conservative Chair of the Women and Equalities Committee, Maria Miller, opened a debate on sexual harassment and sexual violence in schools. She said it was a timely debate, and the current Westminster scandal hung heavy over proceedings.
Frankly, if Parliament can't get it right, what example are we setting to the rest of the country?
Maria Miller set out the scale of the problem facing youngsters.
2 in 3 girls under the age of 21 experiencing sexual harassment, according to the Girl Guiding Attitude Survey. In evidence sessions, colleagues heard about children having their breasts grabbed pinging bras, lifting skirts, pinching bottoms, all part of routine daily life for girls at school in this country today.
But she saw some hope for the future.
If we tackle the behaviour of sexual harassment and abuse early on, if we teach children about healthy relationships and respect, if we properly regulate social media and digital communications, we may be able to start to tackle the root causes of the sort of sexual harassment we see so prevalent in wider society today.
Labour's Jess Phillips said there wasn't a clear process in place to deal with peer-on-peer abuse, which she said should be called child abuse.
On the committee, we heard cases and heard from parents whose children had been left in the same classroom as their perpetrator. And the complaint that we have is not just how harrowing that is, but the fact that there is no guidance on this. There is no process to know what to do with this.
Her fellow Labour MP, John Mann, said there was ignorance about the scale of the problem. He called for compulsory consent training in schools, colleges and universities.
And I think that would have a huge impact. And I think that we should have here that training. We men in here should have that training as well. I think that should be compulsory as a requirement of sitting as a member of Parliament.
The Liberal Democrat, Leila Moran, used to be a secondary school teacher. She said she'd get 13 and 14-year-olds to put anonymous questions into a hat, which were then pulled out and discussed in class.
I used to find myself shocked at both what they knew, which has been alluded to before, the sort of porn and destructive relationships that they thought were just normal, but also what they didn't know. And most harrowing was the fact that so many of them didn't know when it was okay to say no.
The Education Minister, Anne Milton, agreed with John Mann's point about consent training and said it was clearly needed in the Commons. But she said she didn't think the House was sexist.
I think it just smells a boy's bit, actually, to be honest.
Anne Milton is a former public health minister, and it was brought home to her then how very much more complicated life was for young people, with club drugs, contraception, sexually transmitted diseases.
And if you now overlay on that all that is on social media, all the pornography that is freely available, all the coercive sexual behaviour that we know goes on in schools, sexual assault and rape in or outside the classroom, it is absolutely clear we have much more to do to make young people more resilient, more able to resist the challenges they face. And there is no doubt there is an urgency to do exactly that.
And those comments from Anne Milton bring us to our closing headline. The Leader of the Commons, Andrea Leadsom, told MPs that Parliament needed to change, as she confirmed that party leaders at Westminster will meet on Monday to discuss plans to deal with sexual harassment and abuse. I'm Sean Curran. The editor was Rachel Byrne. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.